So our founding fathers gave us a constitution conforming to these great truths in respect to men in government and establishing a government of laws. And they intended this constitution to endure for the ages as the rule for the guidance and government of the public officials and the people alike. And there is no reason in the world why our constitution cannot endure for the ages as they intended it to do. We sometimes think of America as being a comparatively young nation, and yet our Constitution is now the oldest continuously existing instrument of government on the face of the earth. It should endure for the ages for these reasons. In the first place, the Constitution has provisions in it whereby it can be amended to remove from it defects which may be discovered. And in the second place, the grants of power which the Constitution grants to government and the liberties which it enshrines for the benefit of the individuals and the limitations which it places upon government extend into the indefinite future. And for that reason, our Constitution should endure for the ages as a rule for the guidance and government of officers and people alike. So the third great freedom they gave us in the Constitution to enable us to pursue happiness is political freedom in the respects which I have enumerated. God gave man a brain and placed him among surroundings which present a constant challenge to the unceasing use of that brain. You have this great university in order to the young people of Alaska might receive training and education to enable them to employ that God-given faculty, the human intellect. The soothsayers of ancient India had an expression which I love because there's so much wisdom in it. They said, when thou attainest 100 years, cease to learn. Now that was the negative statement of a principle which they were designed to emphasize, namely that you should try to learn something each day as long as you live, and not to let anything on this side of the grave put an end to your pursuit of learning. Fortunate indeed is the man or the woman who adopts this as a principle of life. And if they adopt this as a principle of life, always to strive to learn something each day, they can say in modesty and truth at sunset each day, I am wiser today than I was yesterday. And I don't know anything, any achievement, that would be greater than that in our quest for happiness. It's difficult to believe and recognize the truth proclaimed by history. Although, as Thomas Jefferson said in the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, that God made the mind of man free, men have attempted to imprison the mind of men. For all the generations preceding the writing of the First Amendment, the British government undertook by law to suppress the free use of the mental faculties by the men and women of England. They did not wish to have a dissent in respect to matters of government. And as we'll see in a moment or two, they did not wish to have a dissent from religion as taught by the state church in the religious matters. The people of England had a law known as the law of seditious libel. Under this law, any Englishman who criticized the king or parliament or the courts or any governmental official was guilty of the crime of seditious libel. And the strange thing about this crime was that truth was no defense to a prosecution for seditious libel. On the contrary, truth made the offense worse. The theory being that if a man told the truth about a public official, the people were more likely to believe it than if he told a lie about him, and therefore would weaken the confidence of people in government more. And so, if he told the truth rather than falsehoods, he received more severe punishment. Now, this law of seditious libel was brought to America by the colonists from England as a part of the law of the colonists. And it's not to be wondered that a great apostle of freedom, like Thomas Jefferson, would say, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to all forms of tyranny over the mind of man." And so we had a great struggle. And as a result of that great struggle for freedom of the mind, the First Amendment was written into the Constitution. And the First Amendment gives every American the right to think anything he wants to think about anything under the sun. That's a great right, of which Englishmen up to that time had been deprived. And so in addition to the right to think anything he wishes to think about anything under the sun, by the First Amendment, they gave any American the right to speak or to publish anything he thought, provided what he said or published did not falsely libel another, and did not constitute obscenity, and did not obstruct courts in the administration of justice or legislative bodies in the performance of their legislative functions, and did not incite others to commit crime. So these are the great freedoms of the mind. These are the great intellectual freedoms that the Constitution gives us in order that we may pursue happiness by exercising freely our God-given mental faculties. And so you might call it intellectual freedom, the fourth great freedom that the Constitution gives us in order that we might pursue happiness. Now, the fifth great freedom operates in the field of religion. Mankind is innately religious, and he desires to worship Almighty God, as so many of the constitutions of the original states say, according to the dictates of his own conscience. But the same forces that attempted to prevent Englishmen from having freedom of the mind prevailed in the field of religion. England had a state church. All Englishmen were required to worship in that church and to pay taxes to the support of that church. And those who dissented from the doctrines of the established church were subjected to severe civil disabilities. They were denied the right to hold office. And that is the reason that our Constitution has got a provision in it that no religious test as a qualification for office shall ever be recognized in the United States. They not only imposed these disabilities on the dissenters as individuals, but they denied dissenting ministers of dissenting congregations the right to administer sacraments such as baptism and marriage. And men were required to go before ministers of the established church, even though they were dissenters, to speak their marriage vows. Now, this was another field in which Thomas Jefferson manifested his fidelity as a great apostle of freedom. He began his fight in the state of Virginia, where they had an established church. And he drew one of the most remarkable statutes that this nation has ever known is the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And in this statute, he gave to all Americans in Virginia the right to worship God according to their own consciences, and he declared that to compel a man to make contributions of money to the dissemination of religious opinions he disbelieves is sinful and tyrannical. And this great statute of Virginia for religious freedom was piloted through the Virginia legislature by Thomas Jefferson's protege, James Madison. And it was later embodied in the religious clauses of the First Amendment. The value which Thomas Jefferson placed upon these freedoms, which allow us to pursue happiness, is illustrated by the epitaph which marks his gravestone. The home of Thomas Jefferson Monticello stood on this hill which overlooks the University of Virginia. As one ascends the road leading up that hill to his residence, he passes the graveyard of the Jefferson family. And he passes the place where the immortal dust of Thomas Jefferson rests in the tongueless silence of the dreamless dust. But this epitaph, which was written by Thomas Jefferson, shows what Thomas Jefferson thought of these great freedoms. At the time he wrote the epitaph, Jefferson had been a member of the House of Burgesses, that's the lower house of the Virginia legislature. He had been governor of the great state of Virginia. He had been ambassador to France. He had been secretary of state. He had been vice president. And he had been twice president of the United States. He did not wish to be remembered for the offices he had held or the honors which he had received. He wanted to be remembered for the services which he had rendered to the American people for the cause of freedom. And his epitaph says, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the American Declaration of Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and founder of the University of Virginia." The reference to his being the founder of the University of Virginia exemplified the fight he had made for intellectual freedom for Americans. And his reference to, the American Declaration of Independence referred to the great fight he'd made for political freedom. And his reference to the Statute of Virginia referred to the fight he had made and secured by the adoption of the First Amendment to give us religious freedom. Now, these five great freedoms, economic freedom, personal freedom, political freedom, intellectual freedom, and spiritual or religious freedom, are the great freedoms which enable us to pursue happiness and give to every American an opportunity to make of himself or herself everything which his or her energy or ambition or creator gave him or her any possibility of becoming. Now, it would seem that all people should love freedom. All people do love freedom for themselves. But there are a multitude of Americans that do dislike to have freedom exercised by people who disagree with them. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said that the best test of one's devotion to freedom of speech is his willingness to defend the right of another to utter thoughts which he hates. And that's a very severe test for any of us to meet. One of the great truths of life is that the contest between freedom and tyranny never ceases. Rudyard Kipling, the great English poet, in a poem called The Old Issue, describes for us how the fight between freedom and tyranny goes on forever. And he points out that all we have of freedom, all we use to know, This our fathers bought for us long and long ago, and the men who framed our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution created these great freedoms for us, but they have many enemies. The men who drew our Constitution gave us two warnings. The first is that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And the second is that a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty. In our bicentennial year, we should take occasion to recur frequently to these fundamental principles, and we should exercise eternal vigilance. Judge Learned Hand was one of the wisest jurists that the North American continent has ever produced. He made a great speech which he called The Spirit of Liberty. And in that speech, which every American ought to read, he said sometimes he thinks that we repose too much in courts and laws and the Constitution for the preservation of our freedoms. He says, as long as the love of liberty lives in the hearts of men and women of America, we need no Constitution, we need no law, we need no courts to preserve it. But when the love of liberty dies in the hearts of the men and women of America, no Constitution, no law, no court can do much to help it. And that is a true statement and a very sad truth. And it seems to me that as Americans, during our bicentennial year, we should dedicate ourselves to the proposition that we must do everything in our power to make the love of liberty burn and glow and live in the hearts of the men and women of our country. Now, there was another great warning which Daniel Webster gave us in this connection. And he said something whose truth has been demonstrated by all human experience, that God grants liberty only to those who love it and are always ready to guard and defend it. A great justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Justice Sutherland, said this: the saddest epitaph which can be carved for the loss of a vanished right is that those who had the power failed to stretch forth a saving hand while there was yet time. And the greatest obligation which rests upon you and me as Americans is to be always ready to guard and defend these five great freedoms which enable us to pursue happiness, and to resolve that no epitaph shall ever be carved on account of their loss. And that's the finest thing we can do for ourselves and our children and our children's children and for our country. Thank you.
Mark Twain once said that we Americans enjoy three great gifts: the freedom of conscience, the freedom of speech, and the wisdom not to overexercise either. I hope, however, that tonight you will exercise your freedom of speech, exercise your conscience, and question the senator. I'll be glad to receive questions from the audience. But before I do, I think maybe I ought to make you a promise and give you a warning. My promise is I won't plead the Fifth Amendment. I may have to plead ignorance. And my warning is arises out of the speech which a politician was making on one occasion. He said, I paused to ask myself a question. And some voice in the gallery came out and said, don't do it, because if you do, you're sure to get a fool answer. Now, with all those promises and those warnings, I'll take your question.
Yes, sir. I watched all your Watergate hearings. You got a great deal of respect for it. But I'd
like to know how you feel about Richard Nixon's trip to China. I thought his trip to China was a very unwise thing. As near as I can figure out, the Chinese then were in a struggle for power, and the group that invited him to China were trying to make it appear that he was still the President of the United States and representing the American people. And it seems to have had some effect in China, because that group retained its power and the other group lost its power. And I think it was unfortunate in that it was an interference really with the exercise of foreign policy-making power by those appointed by our Constitution to exercise such power. He had lost it. I don't think they said anything expressly in the Constitution about that. Of course, they gave Congress to pass laws under which Congress can put responsibilities on the people. I think they thought that the American people would be so gratified with the possession of these rights that they would exercise them. And unfortunately, a lot of Americans don't even take the trouble to go out and vote. And a lot of Americans say, I won't have anything to do with politics because politics is dirty business. I wish you'd repeat your question. I didn't hear part of it.
How do you equate the ability of today's American government to men like Jefferson or Madison?
Well, I don't. I sometimes think that with Johnson, that those days that we don't have now, especially in government. I think too many of our office holders spend too much time reading political platforms instead of thinking.
Senator, you voted against the last to become the state of the Union.
Yes. The Supreme Court of the United States has held that every state must be admitted into the Union on a basis of equality with other states. I was in favor of statehood for Alaska, but I was not in favor of the provisions of the statehood bill. The statehood bill reserved a right of control over the resources of Alaska for the federal government, and even gave the federal government the power to withdraw some of the land included in the state. And that was compelling Alaska to come into the Union on a basis which was inferior to that of every other state that was had ever been admitted to the Union, and I thought it was a violation of the Constitution, and I felt like if Congress would reject that bill, that the Congress would speedily pass a just and fair bill which gave the same equality to Alaska that all the other states had enjoyed at the time of their admission to the Union.
statehood compact was not only a short change to us, but it's also been violated by the federal government. We had 25 years to elect 103 million acres. Before that time expired, they've taken 40 million acres for the Native people, with which I do not agree. They have taken 100 million acres now under consideration for withdrawal. What do you think of our chances of asking that the statehood contract be set aside for substantial violation and that the people of Alaska be allowed to vote again upon their relationship with the United States?
Well, I think the most appropriate remedy would be for you all to work on Congress and point out these things to Congress, because I think that the average congressman wants to be fair. But you have to sometimes give them a lot of education for them to know what is fair.
Sir, could you give us your thoughts on the Second Amendment?
Well, the Second Amendment is somewhat confusing. The first part of it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be abridged. The first part sounds like it just gives the militia the right to bear arms. The second part sounds like it gives the people the right to bear arms. And I'd have some difficulty determining if I had to interpret it by myself. But the Supreme Court of the United States and two lower federal courts have interpreted it to mean that the only people that get the right to bear arms under this are people who are in the militia, or people who have arms which are suitable for the use of the militia in time of war. And so if you disagree with that proposition, you have to argue it out with the Supreme Court instead of me. Well, bypassing the last part of your question first, I have a profound respect for the mental integrity of Bernstein and Woodard for personal reason. When I was appointed chairman of the committee to investigate the Watergate affair, we had a week's vacation, and I got photostatic copies, or Xerox copies rather, of all of the articles which Bernstein and Woodard had written for the Washington Post. And I took them home and read them. It took me about a week. I came back to Washington and I called them and asked them to come to see me. And I told them that they were kind enough to come, and I told them that I didn't want to know what they'd found out about Watergate, because I'd read all of that in the articles which had appeared in the Washington Post, that I wasn't going to ask them about the sources of their information, because I knew that was contrary to the ethics of a newspaper man to divulge the sources of his information. And what I wanted to ask them was to tell me what they suspected had happened and who they suspected had been involved that they couldn't prove had happened and couldn't prove was involved. And so they told me who they thought was involved, and it turned out in our subsequent investigations, as we got evidence that they hadn't assembled, that they were right in all of their views as to who was involved and as to what happened. And so I have a lot of respect for their integrity. Now, with reference to the final days, I have read the extracts of the final days which appeared in the Newsweek, and it presents a truly pathetic picture, enough to excite almost anybody's compassion. But at the same time, I've always felt that the American people are entitled to the truth, regardless of what the truth is. And any man who occupies the office of President of the United States loses his right of privacy because he actually lives in a goldfish bowl. So I think they were in their perfect right to publish these things. And I noticed that the columnists, some of the columnists who have criticized them for so doing, I read their articles over the air, and I never saw them refrain from exposing anything they could find on any public men, especially those in low positions. So our founding fathers gave us a constitution conforming to these great truths in respect to men in government and establishing a government of laws. And they intended this constitution to endure for the ages as the rule for the guidance and government of the public officials and the people alike. And there is no reason in the world why our constitution cannot endure for the ages as they intended it to do. We sometimes think of America as being a comparatively young nation, and yet our Constitution is now the oldest continuously existing instrument of government on the face of the earth. It should endure for the ages for these reasons. In the first place, the Constitution has provisions in it whereby it can be amended to remove from it defects which may be discovered. And in the second place, the grants of power which the Constitution grants to government and the liberties which it enshrines for the benefit of the individuals and the limitations which it places upon government extend into the indefinite future. And for that reason, our Constitution should endure for the ages as a rule for the guidance and government of officers and people alike. So the third great freedom they gave us in the Constitution to enable us to pursue happiness is political freedom in the respects which I have enumerated. God gave man a brain and placed him among surroundings which present a constant challenge to the unceasing use of that brain. You have this great university in order to the young people of Alaska might receive training and education to enable them to employ that God-given faculty, the human intellect. The soothsayers of ancient India had an expression which I love because there's so much wisdom in it. They said, when thou attainest 100 years, cease to learn. Now that was the negative statement of a principle which they were designed to emphasize, namely that you should try to learn something each day as long as you live, and not to let anything on this side of the grave put an end to your pursuit of learning. Fortunate indeed is the man or the woman who adopts this as a principle of life. And if they adopt this as a principle of life, always to strive to learn something each day. They can say in modesty and truth at sunset each day, I am wiser today than I was yesterday. And I don't know anything, any achievement that would be greater than that in our quest for happiness. It's difficult to believe and recognize the truth proclaimed by history. Although, as Thomas Jefferson said in the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, that God made the mind of man free, men have attempted to imprison the mind of men. For all the generations preceding the writing of the First Amendment, the British government undertook by law to suppress the free use of the mental faculties by the men and women of England. They did not wish to have a dissent in respect to matters of government. And as we'll see in a moment or two, they did not wish to have a dissent from religion as taught by the state church in the religious matters. The people of England had, England had a law known as the law of seditious libel. Under this law, any Englishman who criticized the king or parliament or the courts or any governmental official was guilty of the crime of seditious libel. And the strange thing about this crime was that truth was no defense to a prosecution for seditious libel. On the contrary, truth made the offense worse. The theory being that if a man told the truth about a public official, the people were more likely to believe it than if he told a lie about him, and therefore would weaken the confidence of people in government more. And so, if he told the truth rather than falsehoods, he received more severe punishment. Now, this law of seditious libel was brought to America by the colonists from England as a part of the law of the colonists. And it's not to be wondered that a great apostle of freedom, like Thomas Jefferson, would say, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to all forms of tyranny over the mind of man." And so we had a great struggle. And as a result of that great struggle for freedom of the mind, the First Amendment was written into the Constitution. And the First Amendment gives every American the right to think anything he wants to think about anything under the sun. That's a great right, of which Englishmen up to that time had been deprived. And so in addition to the right to think anything he wishes to think about anything under the sun, by the First Amendment they gave any American the right to speak or to publish anything he thought, provided what he said or published did not falsely libel another, and did not constitute obscenity, and did not obstruct courts in the administration of justice or legislative bodies in the performance of their legislative functions, and did not incite others to commit crime. So these are the great freedoms of the mind. These are the great intellectual freedoms that the Constitution gives us in order that we may pursue happiness by exercising freely our God-given mental faculties. And so you might call it intellectual freedom, the fourth great freedom that the Constitution gives us in order that we might pursue happiness. Now, the fifth great freedom operates in the field of religion. Mankind is innately religious, and he desires to worship Almighty God, as so many of the constitutions of the original states say, according to the dictates of his own conscience. But the same forces that attempted to prevent Englishmen from having freedom of the mind prevailed in the field of religion. England had a state church. All Englishmen were required to worship in that church and to pay taxes to the support of that church. And those who dissented from the doctrines of the established church were subjected to severe civil disabilities. They were denied the right to hold office. And that is the reason that our Constitution has got a provision in it that no religious test as a qualification for office shall ever be recognized in the United States. They not only impose these disabilities on the dissenters as individuals, but they denied dissenting ministers of dissenting congregations the right to administer sacraments such as baptism and marriage. And men were required to go before ministers of the established church, even though they were dissenters, to speak their marriage vows. Now, this was another field in which Thomas Jefferson manifested his fidelity as the great apostle of freedom. He began his fight in the state of Virginia, where they had an established church, and he drew one of the most remarkable statutes that this nation has ever known, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And in this statute, he gave to all Americans in Virginia the right to worship God according to their own consciences, and he declared that to compel a man to make contributions of money to the dissemination of religious opinions he disbelieves is sinful and tyrannical. And this great statute of Virginia for religious freedom was piloted through the Virginia legislature by Thomas Jefferson's protege, James Madison. And it was later embodied in the religious clauses of the First Amendment. The value which Thomas Jefferson placed upon these freedoms, which allow us to pursue happiness, is illustrated by the epitaph which marks his gravestone. The home of Thomas Jefferson Monticello stood on this hill which overlooks the University of Virginia. As one ascends the road leading up that hill to his residence, he passes the graveyard of the Jefferson family, and he passes the place where the immortal dust of Thomas Jefferson rests in the tongueless silence of the dreamless dust. But this epitaph, which was written by Thomas Jefferson, shows what Thomas Jefferson thought of these great freedoms. At the time he wrote the epitaph, Jefferson had been a member of the House of Burgesses, that's the lower house of the Virginia legislature. He had been governor of the great state of Virginia. He had been ambassador to France. He had been secretary of state. He had been vice president. And he had been twice president of the United States. He did not wish to be remembered for the offices he had held or the honors which he had received. He wanted to be remembered for the services which he had rendered to the American people for the cause of freedom. And his epitaph says, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the American Declaration of Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and founder of the University of Virginia." The reference to his being the founder of the University of Virginia exemplified the fight he had made for intellectual freedom for Americans. And his reference to the American Declaration of Independence referred to the great fight he'd made for political freedom. And his reference to the Statute of Virginia referred to the fight he had made and secured by the adoption of the First Amendment to give us religious freedom. Now, these five great freedoms, economic freedom, personal freedom, political freedom, intellectual freedom, and spiritual or religious freedom, are the great freedoms which enable us to pursue happiness and give to every American an opportunity to make of himself or herself everything which his or her energy or ambition or creator gave him or her any possibility of becoming. Now, it would seem that all people should love freedom. All people do love freedom for themselves. But there are a multitude of Americans that do dislike to have freedom exercised by people who disagree with them. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said that the best test of one's devotion to freedom of speech is his willingness to defend the right of another to utter faults which he hates. And that's a very severe test for any of us to meet. One of the great truths of life is that the contest between freedom and tyranny never ceases. Rudyard Kipling, the great English poet, in a poem called The Old Issue, describes for us how the fight between freedom and tyranny goes on forever. And he points out that all we have of freedom, all we use and know, this our fathers bought for us long and long ago. And the men who framed our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution created these great freedoms for us. But they have many enemies. The men who drew our Constitution gave us two warnings. The first is that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And the second is that a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty. In our bicentennial year, we should take occasion to recur frequently to these fundamental principles. And we should exercise eternal vigilance. Judge Learned Hand was one of the wisest jurists that the North American continent has ever produced. He made a great speech which he called The Spirit of Liberty. And in that speech, which every American ought to read, he said sometimes he thinks that we repose too much in courts and laws and the Constitution for the preservation of our freedoms. He says, as long as the love of liberty lives in the hearts of men and women of America, we need no Constitution, we need no law, we need no courts to preserve it. But when the love of liberty dies in the hearts of the men and women of America, no Constitution, no law, no court can do much to help it. And that is a true statement and a very sad truth. And it seems to me that as Americans, during our bicentennial year, we should dedicate ourselves to the proposition that we must do everything in our power to make the love of liberty burn and glow and live in the hearts of the men and women of our country. Now, there was another great warning which Daniel Webster gave us in this connection. And he said something whose truth has been demonstrated by all human experience, that God grants liberty only to those who love it and are always ready to guard and defend it. A great justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Justice Sutherland, said this: the saddest epitaph which can be carved for the loss of a vanished right is that those who had the power failed to stretch forth a saving hand while there was yet time. And the greatest obligation which rests upon you and me as Americans is to be always ready to guard and defend these five great freedoms which enable us to pursue happiness, and to resolve that no epitaph shall ever be carved on account of their loss. And that's the finest thing we can do for ourselves and our children and our children's children and for our country. I thank you.
Mark Twain once said that we Americans enjoy three great gifts:
The freedom of conscience, the freedom of speech, and the wisdom not to overexercise either. I hope, however, that tonight you will exercise your freedom of speech, exercise your conscience, and question the senator.
I'll be glad to receive questions from the audience. Yes, but before I do, I think maybe I ought to make you a promise and give you a warning. My promise is I won't plead the Fifth Amendment. I may have to plead ignorance. And my warning is arises out of the speech which a politician was making on one occasion. He said, I paused to ask myself a question. And some voice in the gallery came out and said, don't do it, because if you do, you're sure to get a fool answer. Now, with all those promises and those warnings, I'll take your question.
Yes, sir. I watched all your Watergate hearings. You got a great deal of respect for it. What I'd like to know is, how do you feel about Richard Nixon's kind of possible effect on
I thought his trip to China was a very unwise thing. As near as I can figure out, the Chinese then were in a struggle for power, and the group that invited him to China were trying to make it appear that he was still the President of the United States and represented the American people. And it seems to have had some effect in China, because that group retained its power and the other group lost its power. And I think it was unfortunate in that it was an interference really with the exercise of foreign policy-making power by those appointed by our Constitution to exercise such power. He had lost it. I don't think they said anything expressly in the Constitution about that. Of course, they gave Congress to pass laws under which Congress can put responsibilities on the people. I think they thought that the American people would be so gratified with the possession of these rights that they would exercise them. And unfortunately, a lot of Americans don't even take the trouble to go out and vote. And a lot of Americans say, I won't have anything to do with politics because politics is dirty business. I wish you'd repeat your question. I didn't hear part of it.
How do you equate the ability of the Danes there, Governor, to men like Jefferson or Madison?
Well, I don't. I sometimes think that with Johnson, that those days that we don't have now, especially in government, I think too many of our office holders spend too much time reading political platforms instead of thinking.
Senator, you voted against the last becoming a state. Would you please explain?
Yes. The Supreme Court of the United States has held that every state must be admitted into the Union on a basis of equality with other states. I was in favor of statehood for Alaska, but I was not in favor of the provisions of the statehood bill. The statehood bill reserved a right of control over the resources of Alaska for the federal government, and even gave the federal government the power to withdraw some of the land included in the state. And that was compelling Alaska to come into the Union on a basis which was inferior to that of every other state that had ever been admitted to the Union, and I thought it was a violation of the Constitution, and I felt like if Congress would reject that bill, that the Congress would speedily pass a just and fair bill which gave the same equality to Alaska that all the other states had enjoyed at the time of their admission to the Union. Well, I think the most appropriate remedy would be for you all to work on Congress and point out these things to Congress, because I think that the average congressman wants to be fair. But you have to sometimes give them a lot of education for them to know what is fair. Well, the Second Amendment is somewhat confusing. The first part of it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be abridged. The first part sounds like it just gives the militia the right to bear arms. The second part sounds like it gives the people the right to bear arms. And I'd have some difficulty determining if I had to interpret it by myself, but the Supreme Court of the United States and two lower federal courts have interpreted to mean that the only people that get the right to bear arms under this are people who are in the militia, or people who have arms which are suitable for the use of the militia in time of war. And so if you disagree with that proposition, you'll have to argue it out with the Supreme Court instead of me.
Concerning publications such as All the President's Men, The Final Days, and the movie All the President's Men, how do you regard the integrity of Woodward and Bernstein and the impact that these publications might have on the country?
Well, bypassing the last part of your question first, I have a profound respect for the mental integrity of Bernstein and Woodard for a personal reason. When I was appointed chairman of the committee to investigate the Watergate affair, we had a week's vacation, and I got photostatic copies, or Xerox copies rather, of all of the articles which Bernstein and Woodard had written for the Washington Post. And I took them home and read them. It took me about a week. I came back to Washington and I called them and asked them to come to see me. And I told them that they were kind enough to come, and I told them that I didn't want to know what they'd found out about Watergate, because I'd read all of that in the articles which had appeared in the Washington Post, that I wasn't going to ask them about the sources of their information, because I knew that was contrary to the ethics of a newspaper man to divulge the sources of his information. That what I wanted to ask them was to tell me what they suspected had happened and who they suspected had been involved that they couldn't prove had happened and couldn't prove was involved. And so they told me who they thought was involved, and it turned out in our subsequent investigations, as we got evidence that they hadn't assembled, that they were right in all of their views as to who was involved and as to what happened. And so I have a lot of respect for their integrity. Now, with reference to this, the final days, I have read the extracts of the final days which appeared in the Newsweek, and it presents a truly pathetic picture, enough to excite almost anybody's compassion. But at the same time, I've always felt that the American people are entitled to the truth, regardless of what the truth is. And any man who occupies the office of President of the United States loses his right of privacy because he actually lives in a goldfish bowl. So I think they were in their perfect right to publish these things. And I noticed that the columnists, some of the columnists who have criticized them for so doing, I read their articles over the air, and I never saw them refrain from exposing anything they could find on any public men, especially those in lower positions.